name of the game is speed. It's very often not the best product that necessarily wins, but it's the one that gets there fastest and has a strong offering that they can improve from. Because if you come up with something stronger later, they'll learn from you, but they'll have the customers.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. If you're an entrepreneur or you aspire to be an entrepreneur, you're in the right place. You've found the podcast for you. Each week, I chat to incredible entrepreneurs. And this week, I'm chatting to Alan Holland, the founder of Keelvar. A disclaimer, before COVID happened, I knew very little about the world supply chain. And I think none of us did, really. But did you know one of the companies powering the world supply chain is based out of Cork? And they're called Keelvar. And they just raised, a couple of days ago, $24 million. They're a company on an absolute rocket ship trajectory. They hired over 60 people during COVID. They're expanding like crazy. They have 70 of the Fortune 500 as their clients. This is simply a phenomenal story. And if I'm honest, these are the stories I love telling because they're a little bit under the radar. I love finding entrepreneurs who haven't been able to tell their story or haven't got the chance to tell their story. And now Alan does. He left his job as a lecturer at UCC to found the startup in 2012. And they are on the verge of something absolutely spectacular. This is an incredible chat. We have a wide-ranging chat. There's a lot of predictions made in here. And you're going to come away from this with a bigger understanding of how the world works. It's a big claim. First, quick shout out to my sponsor, Sage. Working smarter is the key to success as an entrepreneur in 2022. That is why I've partnered with Sage. Sage is the trusted global provider of finance, HR, and payroll software to help small and medium businesses like me and you thrive. To learn more about Sage, go to sage.com or click the link in the pod description. Alan, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Delighted to join you on this beautiful Friday morning.
Indeed. It's a bank holiday and it's sunny, so it's everyone's in good form, I hope.
So where are you based, first of all?
I'm based in Cork. And so I'm living in Inishannon, a village on the road to West Cork, coming out of Cork City.
Beautiful. I was down in Skull a few weeks ago and it took a couple of years off my life to drive down.
Yeah, it's a long drive. Even from here, it's a long drive down to Skull. So if you're coming from Dublin, then yeah, my thoughts are with you.
It was beautiful. It was God's country when you get down there, but it's a fair old spin. I guess tell us what you do.
So I'm the founder and CEO of Keelvar, a software company. We provide a SaaS solution to procurement teams in big enterprises, and we help them. Our niche and our focus is very much on helping the biggest companies in the world manage their most challenging or difficult sourcing projects.
And when you say sourcing, what do you mean?
So by sourcing, I mean the act of finding suppliers, negotiating with suppliers for goods and services.
That really couldn't be more topical at the minute. We planned, this lined up lovely. What a time in the world for what you do. It's incredible.
Yeah, there's been massive turmoil in global supply chains in the last couple of years, and there's no signs of that abating, from pandemic to wars to Evergreen ship blocking the Suez Canal and climate change. There's all these black swan events converging, and then you have central banks as well with quantitative easing. So demand has been spiking for goods in various parts of the world that are leading to just huge bottlenecks in certain production systems and processes around various countries.
You said that they're perfectly black swan events. I was actually having this chat with a friend of mine the other day, and we were like, all these events, were these always happening, or do we just know more about them now?
I think that these events, they've always been happening, but because the supply chains have been growing longer, and a supply chain is, it's only as strong as its weakest link. So we had a period of calmness whilst production moved to Asia, and that's the big trend we've seen in the last 20 years. American and European companies outsourcing manufacturing to Asian markets, but there was an assumption that whatever you produce there, you can get the stuff to Europe, and you know, it takes you a few days by air, but a few weeks ocean, and it was predictable and dependable, and it was cost effective. But that changed when demand spiked and supply chains were inflexible, and they just could not deal with the increase in demand.
What was the tipping point? Because you've kind of summed it up beautifully there. There's just been this period of just like, it's like anything, you take it for granted until it stops working. Was there a tipping point, or has this been kind of shaking for a while?
COVID was definitely, I suppose, a catalyst, but there was problems already. There was already the global supply chains were starting to creak before COVID hit. But what happened when COVID first hit was countries like the US, they injected large volumes of cash into their economy to try and stave off recession. But that had very serious side effects. People couldn't spend money on sports events, cinemas, and other services. So they were spending all of this cash on goods, and they were importing all those goods. Most of them are being manufactured abroad because of this dependence we had now on manufacturing in Asia. So there was a huge increase in demand for goods, and what I suppose was particularly difficult for supply chains was that the nature of it meant that within Asia, production was actually being stifled because factories were being closed, and China had a zero COVID policy. So if there's any individual cases in ports, they shut down a whole port. So we see that even presently, still to this day, that any small outbreak leads to a complete shutdown, which snarls up the supply chains and causes chaos. And it can take weeks and months for that to filter through. Even the most recent shutdown in Shanghai, the effects of that haven't been felt in Europe and America yet.
It's really, I was just about to ask you, it's really funny. I was chatting to a friend of mine who works in aviation leasing, and he was chatting to some of their staff in China, and they were like, they haven't left their house in months. And he's like,
yeah,
what's happening over there? They're like, total shutdown. Cannot leave, can't go to the shop, can't go to the corner. They're even erecting fences in certain areas. What happens when that filters through here, and how long will it take?
Yeah, it's what we see is that you just can't get your hands on certain goods and services. Mm-hmm. That, you know, things like, let's say, a car. If you want to buy a car, it used to be that you just turn up at the forecourt and it's like, what have you got in stock? And they don't have cars in stock. They're saying, okay, there's a 6 month waiting list on this model, there's a 12 month waiting list on this other model, but they're not even sure. So they're saying 6 or 12 months. That could be 18 months. It's all COVID dependent. So and that's driving inflation. So, you know, manufacturers who can get cars built, or laptops, or whatever goods it is you're looking to buy, whoever can manufacture has pricing power, and they
okay
can push up prices. And if because they're paying more for transportation and parts and materials as well, so it's driving this inflationary cycle now.
I'm going to ask you a really hard question. Where does this go? Because it just seems to be an upward spiral for the last kind of 4 to 5 months.
Yeah, it's hard. It's very hard to answer that question, because I think that the elephant in the room is COVID in Asia, that they have not controlled COVID. They're trying to keep a lid on it using measures that are not sustainable, that the new variants are just so transmissible that even with the extreme lockdowns they're trying to impose, they can't crush it. They just can't keep it out. So in effect, countries like China are way behind Europe and America in how they're treating and dealing with COVID. Their vaccines have not been as effective. So there's no normal there's no signs of normality resuming there. And if there's no signs of normality there, then there can be no normality here either. So companies are trying to move their production away from the centers, but it took us 25, 30 years to move a lot of production to China. It's going to take a long time to get much of that dependency removed from China. So it's going to take a long time.
I was just going to ask you that because, like, you know, the things you're talking about there are complex things, you know, cars, computers, things like that. They're complex. I'd imagine to skill up a workforce, get the tooling, get the engineering, get all that, a new knowledge base built up must take years. Is that what we're looking at? Are we looking at a whole global shift? I don't even know which way we're going. Are we going west, east? Which way is it going?
Yeah, we are seeing a seismic shift in how supply chains are structured. So companies are, like, you take, say, Tesla's new factory. It's in Germany, not Asia. Mm. That's a high-cost manufacturing country. If 5 years ago, people would have thought, what? You're putting a new car manufacturing facility in a high-cost location like Germany? But it's so that there's a shorter supply chain. And one thing that Germany did right that other European countries didn't do was they saw the strategic benefits of retaining a manufacturing industry. Mm. And they're one of the few countries in Europe that can rebound, and they've got a base, a knowledge base from which to grow that, redevelop that capability, because that's what many companies need to do now.
That's super interesting. Is Eastern Europe still a potential location for many manufacturers? I know there was a slight move there a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it very much is. That's where many companies are favoring new manufacturing sites over Asia. And not because it's necessarily cheaper than Asia. It's just that there's capacity there. There's a shorter supply chain. So they're not going to have the risks of port shutdowns there's political risks everywhere you're looking now. So there's political risks in Eastern Europe, but there's also political risks in Asia. So it's difficult for companies to make commitments that they know they'll be stuck with for decades, and they're looking to de-risk them. Yeah.
So this seems like the perfect business at the perfect time. When did all this get going?
Yeah, so at Keelbar, we started much sooner. I guess it was late 2012 when I actually set up the company, and we came out of a research lab. So long, long before the supply chain disruptions we're witnessing today. But I was a lecturer in computer science in UCC. I used to look at problems in trade and how to make trade more efficient. And I used to have companies knocking on my door saying, okay, look, the work you're doing there, where you're trying to find win-win solutions between suppliers and buying organizations by allowing them be expressive around conditions and economies of scale and so on in their bidding, that was something they were looking for. So there was a pull factor from large enterprises, and I set up Keelbar. We started small and we grew in a fairly bootstrap manner for the first 6 or 7 years, really. Mm. And I think that it was around 2018 when we felt we had a product that was very strong, and I started hiring salespeople who, that's kind of a major milestone for a bootstrap a software company, to hire experienced head of sales, because they're expensive and
your burn goes up.
That's when you're taking on a bit more risk. But we kind of learned that we perhaps overestimated our competitors, and we started winning deals fairly quickly. So we had waited a bit too long. But hindsight is 2020, and we had the good fortune at that point to have a very strong product that surprised our competitors, and they weren't expecting us, because we hadn't landed big rounds of VC money that they normally look out for as signals that there's something strong on the horizon.
So you'd kind of gone in accidental stealth mode. 6 years, that's a long time to keep it under wraps and to be working on it. How did you survive, I guess?
Well, It's, yeah, good question.
I couldn't think of a better way to put it.
when I left the university first, it was 2013 and 14, we started off pointing in the wrong direction. Because when I was in UCC, we did some research projects. They're sponsored by EI, so they kind of generously sponsored some research where we'd proven that this technology was called sourcing optimization, where we kind of apply mathematical optimization to negotiations. And our first examples were with public sector organizations. We had a great case study with Cork City Council, for example, and the Department of Foreign Affairs in Dublin that proved very strong savings. And the suppliers were happy too because their profit margins were going up. They were getting the right combinations of contracts that made them operationally efficient. So we decided to aim for government bodies. And if you remember back to 2012, how bad the Irish finances were, we thought, we've got exactly what they need. And we've shown in a few case studies that we can knock 20, 30% off costs. Surely
I can see where this is going.
Biting our hands off. And it's like, no, they weren't biting our hands off. They were like sending us from one person to another, you know, meeting after meeting. I love this. But you need to convince this other person, and just the list of people you had to convince for so long. It's like it was very disheartening. But the good thing about the public sector procurement is quite transparent. So we could publish case studies, and we were able to write about what we were doing. And bigger enterprises, they sat up and took notice, and some of them did their research, and they saw that what we were doing was what they wanted to do. So they came knocking on our door, and first big enterprise customer of ours was Siemens, and some very savvy people in Munich saw that we had the core skills and we were building on a modern technology stack, and they approached us and said, could you build sourcing optimizer for enterprise rather than public sector procurement? And we said, yep. And we, no problem. They weren't an investor, but it was a sizable initial deal with them, that, and they trusted us because we proved ourselves in a few proof of concepts, and that kind of gave them, that allowed them trust that we could do the job they needed, and we always excelled for them. So 2015, 16, we kind of kept our heads down in just pure product development mode. We had a small enough team, it was five or six people only. And we said, let's just build the strongest product we can. And when you've had a near death experience and you've got a small number of customers, the best thing to do is just keep them happy. Just keep them really, really happy. And when you feel your product is strong enough that you can start taking on more risk. And by taking on more risk, I mean hiring more in sales and marketing, because you don't know if that's going to pay off until you actually start spending the dosh. And it was 2018, we decided, yeah, okay, now I think we're confident enough. But when you're low on cash, you have to be risk averse. Mm. So was it too late? Well, yeah, maybe it was, right? But maybe if we'd gone a year sooner, maybe we wouldn't have been successful, and it might have been high risk, and it would have been squeaky bum time. So who knows? But it worked for us when we did start investing in sales and marketing, and we were getting ready to launch a new product as well, sourcing automation. These were bots. And this is straight out of the research lab in our university days, and this was highly novel. Nobody in the industry had ever done anything like this, where we had software agents that would automate negotiations. That kind of autopilot your negotiations. So what we'd say to our customers is that, like, if sourcing optimization is the Ferrari of e-sourcing, these are the bots that will drive your Ferrari for you. And because many procurement teams would look at a sophisticated solution like sourcing optimizer and say, oh, we don't really have people with advanced skills for that type of product. So with automation, we said, well, that problem's solved now, because we'll give you the software agents that will do. We'll use the tool. So that was that was very well received. So within supply chains, companies were kind of, even before the pandemic, they were fairly swamped with work. So if you could automate the tactical buying and the smaller negotiations where, like, week to week, you might be going out for, 10 containers in 10 different trade lanes around the world because it was ad hoc needs that weren't on your contracted rates because it's not on a major lane, it's a minor trade lane or something. And just have bots do that. So what we saw was we were starting to build our sales team and we had this product that the market was saying, Jesus, we really love this too. Can you do 10 times more of this for us, please? So we kind of changed gears at that point. In late 2019, we decided, look, we actually should be doing a round of funding here because we're growing quickly now, like a more than doubling year on year in revenue. And we raised $18 million in a Series A, but we were able to buy out the seed investors who kind of got us going. And that seed money we'd spent, I suppose, pointing in the wrong direction and looking at public sector procurement, but it was an opportunity for them to cash in as well. And so I was kind of pleased for our seed investors that they had to wait 7 or 8 years, but they got a big return from it. But then now we had a new investor base, a more international investor base as well, with much deeper pockets, and who backed us, and that really powered our growth then. So we had Elephant in Boston, Mosaic in London, Power in Berlin. We were now kind of starting to hit the big time, if you like, and we were driving on, and then we were continuing our growth rate over 100% year on year, and we've continued to do that since our Series A. And then just recently we've moved on to the next milestone, which is Series B, and an even bigger round of funding, and another tier one investor in 83 North has joined. So we're kind of doubling down now and accelerating and really going for larger scale international expansion. So, 2 years ago, our headcount was at about 20. Now it's at 85, and growing rapidly.
You've said a lot there. I need to go back and pick through this. That funding is phenomenal. 18 million. That was your first raise, proper raise. You'd done seed.
We had a seed funding of about 750K. But I suppose that money was spent developing a product that we canned and started from scratch 2 years later with a brand new code base. But we learned a lot, right? So, it's hard to put a value on the learnings you get from making a mistake like that. And it gives you a really fine sense of appreciation of the value of cash flow management. cash is king. It's an important lesson.
What was the moment you touched on it there? That you were like, right, this is the moment to go for it. This is the moment, right? Hammer down, we're going. Can you remember what that was?
Yeah, I can. It was actually, I mentioned that Siemens was our first customer of our sourcing optimizer. And, that was back in 2015 or so. They started with this. And over the next 4 years, they'd kind of grown, but they'd adopted, and we were optimizing billions in spend for them. But when we were developing automation and sourcing bots, and we turned to them and said, this is what we feel the next wave of solutions will look like in procurement and supply chain, that it's all about intelligent automation. They said, absolutely. We 100% agree. Can you give us what you've got? And the first thing we did for them was an ocean freight sourcing bot, and they loved it and it was very well received. And they said, we'll have another four of those, please. We want this A, B, C, and D categories. And after that, we want 10. And we could see, we don't have the capacity to really build as much as they want, and that they wanted to hit the accelerator. And then we had other customers like Logitech and Samsung and BMW and others who were all saying, how much of this can you give us? and we were kind of saying, this is a great problem, but it is a problem. We're not going to be able to build as much as we need for them as quickly as they want it without, an injection of capital here so that we can hire at scale quickly and try and get ahead of the demand rather than be just responding to demand after it's coming in.
Talk to me about that. How do you go from 20 to 85? And I think that was during COVID as well, was it?
Yeah, it was during COVID. So, as we were closing, agreeing terms for that Series A round of funding, I was in London on Regent Street on a Friday. It might have been second week of March or so in 2020 when we were. There was an eerie sense of the streets emptying, and that being the day that, okay, people were leaving offices and not knowing when they'd come back. And there was that air of uncertainty. And we signed our term sheet during that period when some people were thinking, this will be 3-4 weeks. And others were thinking, oh, this might be a bit longer. And so we had, I suppose, strong demand for that Series A. But at the back of my mind, I was worried that, if macro conditions are going to go horribly bad, will this term sheet that's signed, will we get the agreement fully completed and funds transferred in the, the six or seven weeks that you expect normally between a term sheet and closing out a deal? And our investors were, proved their mettle and their, a time like that for investors who manage money, that's when they need to have the courage of their convictions. And that's when their courage can be tested. Mm. And that we were fortunate because it was very unclear to everybody what the implications of this would be. Is this going to lead to carnage or is it going to be massive opportunity? No one really knew. And I think that it was, there was, I suppose, a massive increase in the number of opportunities this presented for us, particularly in the transportation, because we do sourcing optimization for any category. And I think it's good for companies to try and keep your addressable market as broad as you can. And we had been quite disciplined about that. We deal with many transportation buyers, but we also deal with materials buyers and packaging buyers and so on and so on. So we deal with all sorts of industries as well. It's not just automotive, but pharmaceuticals, food, retail, and so on. We just said, okay, let's drive on. Whatever happens, happens. But we're driving on with our plans. And it turned out that, in certain sectors like transportation sourcing, that this drove more opportunities for sure.
Mm. It's the timing was quite fortunate in one way that the round closed at that time. How quickly did you see it impacting you in that way in terms of positively? How quickly did you see going, okay, this is going to be a big problem, but also a big opportunity?
I would say in our first months, if you look at in the 3 or 4 months after COVID first hit, everyone stopped buying anything they didn't absolutely need to wait this out and see what way things are going. So at first it looked like, this could be really terrible. But then it started shifting because you saw US government injecting massive amounts of money into the economy and individuals buying, insatiable appetite for buying goods in the US. And so companies started ramping up production. So companies who'd initially stopped production fearful that, inventories are just going to build up here and no one's going to buy anything, suddenly realized that, it's the opposite.
And it was so strange. Suddenly it was there was such panic. An odd thing.
Yeah. So there was this flip-flopping between stopping everything, hitting the accelerator hard on everything. And it's that type of jerking around of demand levels and supply chains was causing chaos. And what we found then, say 4 or 5 months after COVID first hit, that people were turning to us and saying, procurement is swamped. Just nobody's honoring, like, let's say they have contracted rates for different goods and services. They found their suppliers were just saying, those were negotiated before COVID, and we're just not honoring any of that stuff anymore because the world has changed. So that meant procurement had to go back out to the market more frequently. So they had more work to do. And they were always signing contracts that were shorter term. Even the biggest companies in the world were having to say, okay, we're signing a 1 month or a 3 month contract, not a 12 or 24 month contract. And that meant there was opportunities for us because there was more work for procurement and there's more of a demand for automating sourcing as well.
How did you hire people during COVID? How did that process change for you? Because to hire 20 to 85 people in a normal time is extremely tough, but to do that during the time of such unrest, what was that like?
We only hired our head of talent in January of this year. And I look back now and think, how did we do it? I think we made everyone a recruiter, right? That's kind of, yeah. We just said, look, whether you're in finance or in marketing or sales or engineering, wherever you are, we're going to need more people like you and similar skill sets. So you start defining job specs. Everyone had to start, come up with job specs, and which meant that you didn't really have a harmonized approach to it. So you could have a job spec that has an about Keelvar section for an engineering job that was quite different to another job spec that had an about Keelvar section that said something very different. And so you have all of this, but it's okay. You do things that don't scale initially. You just have to just get on with it and say, and empower everyone to be a recruiter and accept that, okay, look, it's all right. If you're not recruiting in the way that a professional recruiter would do, but people understand that and they're forgiving of that. And it's not a cardinal sin. So what you need to do is identify the people you feel would be best to work with and who you'd like to work with. And we didn't centralize our recruiting much in our early days. And it's only now when we're getting, I suppose we were hitting about 70 people when we hired our head of talent. And she's put a lot more process around it, which is necessary and which is absolutely, I think, absolutely important. But it's okay not to be too process driven too soon, and for every company there's a right time to become more process driven and more controlled and have put in a new system for all our HR and applicant tracking and people needs, and this it's all part of growing up.
And then on that theme, you also then raised a huge amount during COVID times. What was that process like? Because you'd raised just before and then you'd raise kind of during towards the end. What was that like and how did that change?
Yeah. I think what served us well was that we were saying to investors, look, we're not paying any attention to the macro level stuff that we can't control. We're just looking at our own business and pointing at the confidence we have and the opportunities, just very strong pipeline, the fact that look at all, we've 70 customers in the Fortune 500 now that are blue chips. We're all very happy customers. So we could point to them and say, if you want to talk to any of them, you can talk to them. And that, I think that's what gives investors confidence that, yeah, look, these guys are really good at what they do. And you just look at their year-on-year revenue growth. It's obvious they're going places. And you look at a new category like sourcing automation, and these guys are leading it, then it's a strong case. So we were kind of very honest and transparent with investors about what our weaknesses were too, and saying, look, these are the areas where actually, look, we know we could and should be better. Because that's okay to say it's actually a good thing to point out your weaknesses to investors, because you're holding your hands up saying, this is where we're spending your money. If you give us money, we'll fix these things. And we feel that this will add more to our income stream and strengthen the business further. Because if you go to them and say, yeah, we're really strong over here and here and here and here, then they'll say, You don't need our money, so like, why would we? So don't make the mistake of trying to be perfect, but just be very honest with yourself. You kind of have to be honest with yourself first before you can be honest with investors too. So sometimes the biggest failing can be to convince yourself that you've got everything nailed. And if you think like that, then yeah, you'll never fix your problems, because everyone has problems.
It's really interesting. I've noticed that twice now in the conversation. You've used your weaknesses as an advantage. First with the product, you changed it to provide the bots to get over the weakness. And now by showing your weakness to investors, it then showed an advantage as well.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of how a business's self-awareness is key. So always actually be looking at your weaknesses and understanding your weaknesses. Not that you want to be negative about your business, but it's like be talking through how can we turn this into a strength. You know, how can we embrace this in a way so that we can actually use it? And if you are creative about how you think through these problems, then usually there is a way.
How do you walk that line between being self-aware and being overly hard on yourself?
That's a tricky one. I think you have to you almost have to ensure that you don't, that you oscillate between celebrating your strengths but diving into your weaknesses, and it's a timing thing, right? So don't spend weeks navel gazing about your weaknesses, because that'll just get you down, that'll get you into a bad place. You have to look at the cadence, right, of within your business, or whereby you celebrate strengths and wins, and you point out successes of team members, and then you move on to, okay, now how have we not been achieving what we feel we should be, and what can we do about that? And then you switch back. So I think it's about alternating between those modes.
I want to go back a little bit, because you mentioned at the start there you were teaching in the college and you're teaching computer science. How did you make the transition from quite a fixed environment to the most chaotic environment you can go into?
Yeah, it's a culture shock of all culture shocks to move from university research lab where everything's quiet and silent and everyone puts their head down and reads papers and occasionally goes to workshops then, but it's quite a solitary existence in research in many ways, right? And that if you're collaborating, it's in very small groups, very measured ways. Now, I was different to most people in my research lab, though, in one key way, in that I came from a business family. And every dinner time conversation was on the topic of, you know, pricing challenges, or how is a competitor trying to undermine us this week? And even as a 14, 15 year old. So I was always looking at the research problems we had in the lab from the viewpoint of, why is this relevant in the world, and who's going to benefit from this? And like, it's don't get me wrong, it's good to have blue sky thinkers in research labs who don't care about applicability, right? Because actually some of the biggest breakthroughs come from some geniuses who know nothing about the commercial world, but come up with something very novel. And that's why I'm a great advocate of Science Foundation Ireland receiving significant funding, so that blue sky thinkers can just be given the freedom. There's some brilliant people in our universities. Don't encumber them with trying to get their wrap their heads around industrial applicability. They don't need to. They do different things. But I was very much somebody who was a business person in research clothing, and in fact, the whole reason I got into this domain was that when I was looking at a topic for my PhD, in the evenings, I was completing proposals and tenders for procurement teams and who are buying chemicals from my parents' company. So my parents' family business was focused on manufacturing industrial chemicals, and they had to complete these Excel bid sheets, and they never knew from one year to the next if they were going to have You should be sending these water treatment chemicals to Kerry and Donegal and Wexford, or Galway and Dublin and Kildare. And what they wanted to do was to say, well, look, our manufacturing is in Cork. If we win Dublin, then we can give you great price on Kildare, Tipperary, Kilkenny and Leash, because our trucks will be going up and down to Dublin every day. And they weren't allowed to say these things. So that's how I got into this on day one, was that I could see the business need. And when I was in my first weeks as a PhD student, whilst I was tackling that challenge for my parents, I was at AI conferences where they were talking about combinatorial auctions and improving expressiveness in negotiations so that you could generate win-win outcomes. And I thought, this is perfect. That's my topic. And so it kind of snowballed from there, really.
I love that. They're pretty different areas, right? I won't say completely different, because you've managed to draw this beautiful line between the two. But I think that just shows the value of just being a bit more around it, having a bit of experience in different areas, and just, you know, it'll always stand to you in some point. It mightn't be immediately, but down the line, what you're doing now might turn out to be the thing. Suddenly you go, oh, wait, those 3 years I spent doing this, well, now it makes sense.
Exactly. And I would say some of the most fertile areas of research can be very interdisciplinary, where you just take some knowledge from one domain that appears like it's far away from another domain, but combine them together. And then, oh, you've got something that's very novel and makes a big breakthrough in a certain area. You know, so that's what I really loved about research, was the ability to try and connect the dots on things that were quite far away at first glance.
And you're able to shatter that kind of, well, this is how we've always done it, stigma. Whole kind of, I think sometimes when people are too entrenched in an industry, well, this is how we've always done it, and things haven't gone awfully, we're still here. That fear manages to kind of box them in. It kind of keeps them going, but also manages to box them in. If you were looking back to 2012 and you were just starting out in this journey, is there one thing or a couple of things you'd kind of go, definitely Alan, future Alan talking, do this differently?
Yes, there are some things I would it's okay to say to yourself there are things I would do differently if I was doing it again, but I wouldn't beat myself up over making those mistakes at the point in time, because I didn't have all the information I needed. I think the obvious mistake we made was targeting public sector procurement on day one instead of enterprises. Now, we rationalized that by saying that, okay, there's a couple of other startups came out of other universities that were 4 or 5 years ahead of us, and they were serving enterprise exclusively. So we were trying to sidestep them and compete in a market where there's nobody. So, but we didn't study, or we didn't, and maybe it's not fair to say you study a market, but you don't really know until you test it out how well you can sell into it. Because you can do your desk research about it, whether someone will buy from you or not, but that's never going to give you strong confidence levels either. So in retrospect, we should have gone straight for enterprise. But, you know, we learned an important lesson from it. And when we did start tackling the enterprise route, we were very well equipped to addressing that in a way that our competitors couldn't. Because we'd learned so much, and we were able to build from a technology stack right from the foundations, ground up, in a way that would scale.
I think in a way it's a difficult question, because exactly that, you can't really have regrets, because it always brings you to somewhere else. It's probably a better one to ask you for kind of aspiring entrepreneurs. What are the kind of key things, the key couple of tips you'd give them now in 2022, going, right, this is the new world we live in. You know, if you are starting out now, here's what I would do.
Yes, have a good board, I would say, right? That's having board members who will give you an honest critique of what you're doing right and wrong, and be that sounding board, and kind of use them as advisors, not to check boxes, or you need to be willing to have yourself held to account, and don't try to be too controlling of your business. Except that as a business starts out, initially you might be the sole owner, but your ownership will be diluted down and down, and it's a good thing for it to be diluted down, because if any company is going to grow big, it needs input and it needs insights from more and more people because it becomes a much larger and more complex organism. And you need good people around you to help lead that. And there's maybe too much of a culture around founders and this belief that founders are sole visionaries who build companies. It's the leadership team that the founder hires will influence the direction of the company even more so. And you've got to accept that, and you've got to accept that you need to share ownership with them, and investors are going to give you capital to help build at speed, because the name of the game is speed. You know, whatever market you're, if you're selling into any market, and if it's of any significant scale, then others somewhere in the world will be aiming for it too. And it's very often not the best product that necessarily wins, but it's the one that gets there fastest and has a strong offering that they can improve from. Because if you come up with something stronger later, they'll learn from you, and they'll have the customers, and that it may be trickier to get customers off them because there's always a switching cost. So speed is key.
You mentioned something really interesting there about having a board and listening to people around you. How do you find that balance between being, you know, a confident, direct founder like yourself, and who has an ability to drive things forward, but also taking in the advice and opinions of people around you? How do you find that balance? Is that experience, or is that gut, or what is that?
Yeah, I think it's experience over time. You kind of wait input from different individuals based upon the relevancy of their experience. And if their experience is superior to yours in a certain domain, you might want to weight their input higher than your own. And that's what you got to be willing to do. It's self-awareness around whether your skill set and your experience is right for this particular decision. And if it's, you know, sometimes you have to admit yourself, yeah, actually, I am the best person to decide on this. But very often you might have to admit that, oh, okay, if John is saying this and he knows this area better than I do, then yeah, let's go with John's. you know, that's the way you should be thinking.
I like that. Weigh the input. I think it's always very difficult. Even when people ask you for advice, I always caveat it with, look, only basing this on my own experience. I don't really have, no one has the answers for you. At the end of the day, you know, they'll sit back and go, well, there you go, off you go. You know, do what you got to do. But I think weighting the input, that's super, super advice. How do you plan? This is something I ask every kind of busy entrepreneur and founder. How do you plan, say, your day, your week, your quarter, your year?
So we establish our kind of annual plan. Our financial year runs January to December. And we have kind of quarterly cadence in our planning. We have quarterly board meetings. We share quarterly kind of updates with everybody how we're doing. And we plan on a quarterly basis as well. So we'd have our annual plan. We'd have clarity over kind of what we're doing in quarters one and two. But then we have to plan exactly what we're doing more than two quarters out. And we'd have all of our team leaders in marketing, customer success, engineering, and security and HR people, and they would all come together with their plans and their inputs into each quarter, and who they're going to hire, which initiatives they want. We use OKRs to try and be more metric driven around how we're doing relative to how we were planning as well.
And then yourself personally, how do you keep yourself in check, kind of in balance? How do you kind of like balance kind of your private life and public life? How do you keep all that kind of in flow?
Yeah, there's a few things. I think what we've decided to be is very rigid around separation of work and home life, and that we insist everyone switches off at 5:35, you know, 5:45. It's like, no, work is over. Don't be messaging people after work hours. It's only in emergency situations. And that should be rare. It should be a rare occurrence. And we keep to our regular work hours, and that's one important measure. And I think that it's important to, like, there's a few of the the basic essentials in life, healthy food and healthy living and exercise are key. You know, what I'm always reinforcing, even on a presentation to all our new staff members yesterday, I spent 5 or 10 minutes talking about the need to go for walks. I go for one, maybe two walks a day, usually during work hours, clear my head. Mm-hmm. And you come back, you know, with more clarity, and you'll be more productive as well. So it's good for you, good for the company, to have everybody enjoying their work and not feeling like it's overwhelming them. Mm-hmm. And if anybody ever felt that way, then that's our job to fix it and either hire more people, reduce the workload, or ensure there's a healthy balance between your work and your life. And many of our team have said, it's the first company that have come to where people, everyone talks about work-life balance. Mm. Many companies don't live by it. We live by it and we honor it. And that's really important.
That's really interesting, because it's something I've started to think about a lot more. I've started to ask people a lot more, because I think it's going to be, number one, it's going to be a key advantage. And number two, it's going to be super challenging. I think that what we've gone through the last 2 years has upended, I think, a lot of what we thought about work, how we feel about work, how we work. And I think it's kind of gone too much the other way. I think everyone thought, oh, you know, people are going to do nothing, but it's gone too far the other way. People are unable to find that balance between, you know, there's a symbolism and there's a mental switch off between leaving the office. I think you walk out of the office, backpack in the back, whatever, and you're off. Whereas at home, it's like this bleed of time and personal. So I was really interested to ask you that. Dust off your crystal ball again and look into kind of the rest of this year, early next year. What do you see happening kind of in the global markets? You're kind of getting a macro view of everything. What way are you seeing the markets go in terms of, if entrepreneurs and business owners are listening to this going, okay, Alan has fingers on the pulse in terms of logistics and supply, what do you see coming down the line?
Yeah, so I see more volatility coming. I think that COVID is something that's going to continue to rage, particularly in countries that have not had an effective vaccine strategy. So Asian countries that didn't have the vaccines we have, they're going to be in turmoil until they do. There's turmoil also in areas like if you're in tech, you can see that valuations of high growth tech companies have come down severely in the last 6 months. So there's a flight away. There's a flight to safety. Mm. And so companies like slower growth, dependable companies like food companies and so on are doing well in the stock market, but even profitable tech companies are not doing so well. So until uncertainty in the world around pandemic and climate change, that's the kind of, whilst COVID has been this source of noise and certainty and fear, climate change is kind of behind it all, and it's like a much bigger wolf that's coming to bite us. You know, year by year, that's going to get worse. And what are the implications? Are certain countries, like you see, the temperatures in India, for example, now there's something like 700 or 800 million people having to endure unbearable conditions. Is this going to lead to mass migrations of people? What are the secondary effects of this? So I think that whatever happens, expect the unexpected, and things are not we're not really going back to a stable norm like we had in 2019 for quite a while.
If there's entrepreneurs or aspiring entrepreneurs listening, what areas, I think obviously climate change would be one of them for you, what areas do you see opportunity in, and what areas should people be focusing on for opportunity?
Sustainability is, I would say, governments are reacting to it's ironic that large corporations are moving before governments actually on this topic. Large corporations are recognizing the risk that climate change is going to be bringing more floods, hurricanes, all sorts, and governments are just acting so slowly to respond, but corporations are expecting that regulatory changes are on their way. And by that, I mean carbon taxes, like big carbon taxes. Like whatever we think the price of oil is now, it's low compared to what it will be in future years. It's very low. So oil is cheap. energy is cheap. We think it's expensive. It's actually way cheaper now than it will be in a few years. So that's going to change. And big corporations are recognizing in advance of regulatory changes, they're saying, okay, well, governments are moving slowly, but someday they're going to come down with big, big changes on this because they have to. And their hands will be forced on the issue. So let's restructure our supply chains and businesses in advance of that. Because if our factories are in Europe and America, not in Asia, then we're going to be transporting goods shorter distances. So we'll be hedged against some of these oil price risks and so on. So we're going to see reshoring of businesses, a reversal of the trend we saw where this massive flight to Asia, that's all being reversed in the next 10 years. And that's so it's hard to gauge how swiftly that will be, but that's my expectation.
Brilliant. I love when people put it on the line. I love when I get some predictions. I'll clip that and we'll play it again in a few years.
Yeah, play it back to me in a few years.
I love it. One final question on this whole kind of macro thing. Where you say reshoring, where are people going? Where we talked about earlier, Europe, Eastern Europe, is that where people are reshoring?
Europe, it's mainly Eastern Europe or Southern Europe, lower costs, so that they're trying to minimize the impact of that price differential, because they moved to Asia because the costs were so much lower.
Yeah.
Now the costs in Asia increased, but then the transportation costs increased, and then the capacity for transportation became very tight. So there's all these reasons to move it back, but it's still more expensive to manufacture in Eastern Europe or Southern Europe. But they're doing so because they're trying to make those decisions on the basis of what will it be next year and year after and year after that. And in America, they're looking at Mexico, and Mexico is actually going to benefit enormously. And there will be much stronger links between US and Mexico in supply chains.
Donald Trump will lose his mind. What does the next kind of 6 to 12 months look like for Keelbar?
Fast-paced growth. We're
on a
spree. There's jobs listed on, maybe 10 or so jobs listed on a website, but within a couple of weeks, there'll be more jobs. It could be 15, 20. You know, there's lots more jobs in all sorts of roles. So no matter what your background, please reach out. We're hiring.
Class. I'll put that in the show notes as well. I always ask everybody to finish with a book recommendation. Of what kind of, any kind of book that's made an impact on them personally, professionally, or you've just enjoyed it?
I think Play Bigger was a good one.
You'd add the tip of your tongue anyway. I actually, what is that one? I'm not sure I've heard of it.
It's the four authors on it. I can't remember the names of the four authors. Play Bigger is the former investors who It's about building for scale. It's a good book for those that are looking to conquer international markets. If you're not looking to conquer international markets, maybe it's not the right book for you. But if you want to build something, particularly in the software sector, that will address a large market, and there's an opportunity, greenfield opportunity to be seized, then it's a good book that talks through the initiatives and speaks to things like marketing strategies you should have in marketing and sales and team development to support that.
Brilliant. Alan, thank you so much. Where can people learn a little bit more about Keelbar and yourself?
Yes. Yeah, so if you go to keelbar.com, there's lots of background information. Actually, we keep our LinkedIn site. If you want to follow us on LinkedIn, we have lots of materials each week as well, where news we're releasing.
Brilliant. I think LinkedIn's a great untapped resource as well. I think it's a really good spot. Alan, thank you so much for the chat. Really good.
Thank you, Gary.
Hope you enjoyed that chat with Alan and Keelbar. Go check them out online. It's really a company worth investigating. And they're also hiring. So if you are looking for a new role, go check out Keelbar. I'll see you back here next Monday for the Idea Lab.